afternoon, you're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM, and this is Little Atoms, with me, Neil Denny, and with Richard Sanderson. Little Atoms is a show about rationalism, science, humanism, and the progressive left. It's a show that holds the Enlightenment dear. Our guest today is the director of Labour Friends of Iraq, Gary Kent. And now I'll hand over to Richard to introduce Gary.
Thanks, Neil. As Neil said, our guest is Gary Kent, who is the director of Labour Friends of Iraq. Labour Friends of Iraq was launched in 2004 at fringe meetings at the Trades Union Congress and at the Labour Party conference, I assume. It was formed by those who opposed and those who supported the military action in Iraq, but who now see the future as in uniting to support the country's struggle for democracy and labour rights. LFIQ supports the new Iraqi Federation of Trade Unions and independent and secular labour movements. Their original founding statement included this: "History will not forgive us if we fail to give solidarity to grassroots Iraq as its long-suffering people seek a federal, democratic, pluralist and unified Iraq in which there is a full respect for the political rights of all." Gary, welcome to Little Atoms.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Your organisation has made it very clear that you view the trade union movement as being key to the democratisation of Iraq. And this might be puzzling to some in this country, because in this country the trade union movement has arguably become marginalised to some extent, with a membership is a fairly low percentage of the workforce now. Can you explain to us why you see the trade union movement as so important in Iraq?
I think the first thing to say is to remember what life was like under Saddam Hussein. And all independent political, social and economic activity was repressed and brutally. He banned trade unions in the public sector, and he set up his own yellow state-run unions. And Chemical Ali, who was responsible for the attack on Halabja and thousands dying there and in the attacks against Iran, was actually an official of the official Iraqi trade union movement. And for 30 years, under a sort of fascism, people weren't allowed to express themselves. And the trade union movement, which had once been very powerful, back in 1959, the May Day march in Baghdad attracted 500,000 people out of a population of, it's difficult to be exact, but I think about 7 million. So that's a huge social weight to the Iraqi labour movement. As I say, repressed brutally, many of its leaders jailed, tortured, imprisoned, so much so that by the fall of Saddam in 2003, we reckon that the clandestine and exile trade union movement had been reduced to a couple of hundred people. It's now knocking on a million people throughout Iraq who've joined trade unions. And why are they important was your question. It's that trade unions, without being rosy about it, mm-hmm. I mean, they're defensive working class organisations for good and for bad, but they bring together people regardless of their religious and other identities. So there's a real scope in Iraq for a movement bringing together a million people who are Shia, who are Sunni, who are Christian, who are whatever, coming together in defense of their economic rather than their ethnic and religious identity. And the trade union movement in Iraq, with which we've been associated for some years now, wants to help reconstruct Iraq. It wants to rebuild democracy. It wants to retrieve the political and economic sovereignty of Iraq and can play a positive role with what we call grassroots Iraq. I mean, there are all sorts of other organizations, youth, students, women, and professional organizations. And in any society, these are the bedrock of civil society, of democracy, of pluralism. Now, they've got a very tough job for all sorts of reasons that I'm sure we'll go into. But it seems to me that it's the absolutely elementary thing about being on the left, is that you support such organizations.
Let's go back to that, because if we think about why Labour Friends of Iraq was actually set up in the first place, as you just mentioned, it seems to me a no-brainer, really, that regardless of whether you supported or were against the intervention in Iraq, if there's a group in Iraq that people on the left can be behind, it's certainly the trade union movement. But this hasn't proved to be the case, really, has it?
No, I think it's a shameful episode in the history of the British left that so many of the leaders of the anti-war movement, and bear in mind that we come from the anti-war movement, most of the people that founded Labour Friends of Iraq were actively opposed to the war and actively involved in Stop the War Coalition. Once it was over, I remember sitting down, I then worked for Harry Barnes, then an MP, who's mm-hmm. now a joint president of ELFIC, and we sat down after the war. We'd taken different views. He was very strongly opposed to the intervention and voted against it in every single vote in the Commons. He'd actually done his national service in Iraq in
the 50s.
Yeah, I
was reading that, yes. Yeah. So he obviously had a strong attachment to the place.
Yeah, I think it politicised him very substantially because he was an 18-year-old RAF guy in Basra, and all he could see around him was mud huts and open sewers, and I think this radicalised him. So he was strongly opposed to it. I wasn't against it. The anti-war movement was not, to coin a phrase, in my name. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, once it was over, we sort of realised that the name of the game had changed and that what we should be about was reconstruction. And we thought that this would be non-controversial. So we penned an article in The Observer with the then leader of the GMB and another MP, and we tried to get the ball rolling and make contact with the Iraqi trade unions and others.
Sorry to interrupt you. Was this before the official forming of Labour Friends?
Yeah. I mean, it was all rather informal, and Harry was happy enough to be an ambassador in cooperation with the Iraqi trade union movement. Then flash to October 2004, we'd helped the Iraqi Federation of Trade Unions, which is the main independent federation that came out of the war. It actually had an existence as part of the clandestine movement, something called the Workers' Democratic Trade Union Movement, but it transformed itself. And so we helped them at a fringe meeting at the conference, and all hell let loose because there was a huge argument about whether or not the conference should support immediate or fairly rapid withdrawal of troops. And I was mm-hmm. very taken by my friend Abdullah Mussin, who's the international representative of the Iraqi Federation of Trade Unions, who said, look, we didn't ask you to come in, but we'd like a say about when you leave. And I think that argument was very persuasive. And the argument for troops out was defeated by something like 85% to 15. And it revealed to me the stunning ignorance of a great deal of the hard left. For instance, by this time, the United Nations had taken control, so UN Security Council 1546 or whatever it was, of the process. There was a political process sanctioned by the UN. And one of the delegates who was in favour of troops said, well, no one told us this. And as a friend of mine said at the time, well, what do you want us to do? Come around and give you individual tutorials every night? I mean, read the papers. This is a process that's been going on for some months. But as I say, the bitterness that then resulted from us, if you like, taking away their little toy and their potential victory was unbelievable. Within days, George Galloway, for instance, denounced my friend as a quisling. Now, you know, in a student debate, this might be good knockabout stuff, but this is deadly serious. And I think that sort of language you can see as having helped to create the climate in which another guy who I came to know called Hadi Sally was murdered. Now, Hadi's a very interesting guy. He'd come across to the Commons a couple of times. He was a dapper, small, decent man in his 50s who'd been a lifelong communist. He joined the Communist Party probably when he was about 20. He was a printer. He got imprisoned for his activities under Saddam. They were going to execute him. The sentence was commuted, but he'd spent 5 years in prison. He then fled the country, spent most of his life in exile in Sweden, went back, I think, either just before the fall of Saddam or just after, to reform the trade union movement. He came over here a couple of times. I met him at the Commons. He went around the world speaking at international trade union conferences. So a lot of people got to know him. And then January the 4th, 2005, the Mukhabarat, almost certainly Saddam's secret police, former secret police, came. And, they tortured him and they bound him and they blindfolded him and they gagged him. They strangled him. They riddled his body with bullets, I understand. And then they ransacked his house for the details of all the union records. And at this time, there was an SWP theoretician who said that this was just hullabaloo about a communist collaborator. And I'm disgusted that there's that small part of the left. I mean, and I think we have to sort of put it into perspective, it's a small part of the left. It has quite a weight in the leadership of the anti-war movement, but that's becoming less and less important. And I think what we wanted to do was not confront them, because we wanted to get the real energies that had gone into stopping the war, real creative, imaginative efforts.
Well, a lot of people showing that they cared a lot about Iraq.
Yeah. I think there was a naivety about it as well. Yeah. But anyway, nonetheless, the situation had changed. And the Iraqi labour movement, which had come from nowhere, wasn't arguing for immediate troops out. It was arguing that it needed to build up its own security capacity, and that the premature withdrawal of troops would precipitate civil war. And I'm reminded, because I'd had a lot of experience of Ireland in the 70s, mainly the 80s and the 90s, about the arguments for troops out. I remember a friend saying, in response to this argument that there'd be a bloodbath, there's a bloodbath already, let's get it over and done with, which we were in Brighton at the time. So it's very easy to say that in Brighton rather than being in Belfast. It's very easy to say it at the Labour conference.
Can I just clarify that? You mean there's a bloodbath already because of the terrorism, let's pull out, let there be a big bloodbath, but then it'll be over. That was a sort of rather
ridiculous logic. And, and there's a read over. It's not quite the same between that argument about troops out of Northern Ireland and the troops out now. But, you know, the Iraqi trade union movement, the labour movement, communists and others, I mean, they make no bones about them having opposed the war. And like everybody else, they want the troops out. Of course they do. Nobody wants to see a permanent presence of US and UK troops in Iraq. But they want it done in such a way that allows them, as the real resistance is how the trade unions would see themselves, to rebuild their society and to hold it together. And the thing about the Iraqi trade union movement is that they're very keen on a federal, democratic and pluralist solution, which is difficult given the sort of tensions between the Kurds, the Sunni in the middle, and the Shia, and their own experiences of what was effectively apartheid for 80 years under Sunni minority rule and then the Tikrit clan around Saddam. So it's a very difficult situation.
Well, as you've mentioned, of course, the sort of trade union movement is quite a sort of non-partisan way of bringing these groups together.
Yes, I think it is. And can I just mention this time that we've just been on a delegation. We've organised a Labour Friends of Iraq delegation to Iraq, and we went to Iraqi Kurdistan and stayed in Erbil and Sulaymaniyah and went into the mountains. And the highlight of this was our meeting with the 22 leaders of the Iraqi trade union movement from Basra, Baghdad and Babel. I probably got that wrong, who came to see us. And we also met with the Kurdish Workers Union. And we talked Turkey. We had a five-hour summit meeting, if you like, including dinner. And we wanted them to tell us how things were going on the ground and how the British and other labour movements can help them. And although that they have risen from the ashes and recruited lots of members, and they've done all the usual things that trade unions do, you know, they negotiate, increase the minimum wage, they bargain, they've had strikes. But the thing that's really holding them back now is that their assets have been frozen and they're not able to organise in the public sector.
Well, I wanted to raise this point because another thing that I think is ironic about, you know, the lack of support from certain areas of the left is that this does seem to be like a classic case for leftists to be involved with, because the occupying forces, the UK and the US, are not helping here, are they? I mean, they are preventing the formation of the unions.
I'm not so sure that they're preventing the formation of the unions. We've now got, there have been three votes in the last year or so. We've got an elected government. There's been months of wrangling. Hopefully now Al-Jafri has stood down and the new guy's taken over, there will be swift moves towards what I think most Iraqis want, which is a national unity government. I think what's happened is that Saddam instituted the ban back in 87 on public sector organisations.
Is this Decree 8750?
No, this is Decree 150. 8750 is something else. Yes, but Law 150 banned public sector organisation. Now, given that the public sector is about 80% in Iraq, I mean, that's a pretty ferocious ban, and that certainly should be reversed. And the Iraqi constitution guarantees free unions, and the British government and President Bush are all in favour of it as well. But what happened on, I think it was the 8th of August last year, was a small group of ministers got together, and they froze the assets of the unions whilst they drew up a labour code. Now, that new labour code, and that's got sort of lost in all the wrangling since, because there hasn't been an effective government. But the fear that we heard from our Iraqi comrades is that there's an element of the current government that wants to set up essentially sectarian client unions, and they see themselves as non-sectarian and independent. So we've come back with their support, they've asked us to carry this on, to campaign against 150, which was Saddam's law, and the one you mentioned, 8750, which was passed in August. And so that's what we're going to do. I also ought to mention that the people that went on the delegation were, I think, quite high-powered. I was very pleased that we got such a good group of people together. I won't do too much of this, but you
tell us a few of them.
I mean, well, there were 8 of us, and one of the key ones was my old boss, Harry Barnes, who's now a joint president with Anne Cluard of ELFIC. Nice thing when we were there in Erbil was that the Iraqi trade unions conferred honorary membership of the Iraqi trade union movement on Harry, who, as I say, was there 50 years ago, and he joked afterwards it's his policy now to go to Iraq every 50 years. So that was the first one. We had a guy called Dave Anderson, who's a Labour MP in the North East, and he's the chair of ELFIC. Then we had Norma Stevenson from Unison, and Unison were very kind in funding the trip. And Unison have done fantastic work. I mean, they're training the trainers, and we went to this training the trainers session in Erbil, which was about negotiation. And it was just the same as any Unison session here, except for the language was somewhat different. And we had Sue Rogers, who's a member of the TUC General Council, treasurer of the main teachers' union, and chair of its Iraq Solidarity Committee, who, as it happens, also grew up in Kirkuk as a child. And then myself, a guy called Clive Furness, a great man, who was a founder member of CADRI. That was the campaign against repression and for democratic rights in Iraq. So, and Abdullah, who I mentioned, was with us too. So we hope, without blowing our own trumpets, I mean, because it's not a personal thing, that we come back, we've got some weight, hopefully, in the movement, and it's absolutely urgent that we try to persuade the British government and others to put pressure on the Iraqi government to reverse these repressive measures and to have fully and free independent trade unions. And the trade unions, I have to say, desperately, not least because their funds are frozen, need money. For instance, they haven't been able to produce their monthly newspaper. This is costs for about 5,000 copies, about 900 quid a month. So we're aiming, not just from British trade unions, but from others, to help fill the gap, at least on a temporary basis. And there's talk about the possibility of getting money together for a radio station. Because a lot of the parties and unions, certainly in Iraqi Kurdistan, have their own radio and TV stations. And there's been an explosion of pluralism. By no means perfect, because they've only had relatively little time in Iraqi Kurdistan. So we've come back energised, and we've got really good comrades in Iraq, and our message is very simple. Whatever position you took on the war, move on. They need your support, and if you don't support the Iraqi labour movement, what sort of left-winger are you?
It's a good point, and I think we'll probably return to several times during the discussion. I think it's now the point, really, where I wonder if you could give us an impression of what Iraq was like when you visited. Where did you go, and what sort of state is the country in? Because, I mean, we obviously get the news reports here, which invariably are about murders and terrorist attacks. What was your experience?
Well, I think the first thing I ought to caution you about is that Iraqi Kurdistan is quite different from the rest of Iraq at this stage, because it's enjoyed freedom since 1991 when Saddam's forces withdrew and there was an uprising. Just by the by, one of the main things that I think stays with us is that we visited the Red House in Sulaymaniyah. Now, the Red House is a torture centre, or was a torture centre, one of a string of torture centres throughout Iraq. I mean, a bleak, horrible building. It's now pockmarked by bullets, there's rusting hulks of Soviet tanks and anti-aircraft guns and machine guns outside. It's a museum. But 5,000 people died there. And many, many more were tortured, and we saw the blood-stained ropes and the electrodes and the batteries and how they used to sort of hang people by their arms from the ceiling, pull down on their arms, dislocate their shoulders, chuck them in extraordinarily cramped conditions. And time and time again, we met people, leaders in the trade union movement, ministers in parties, who'd all been there. Mm-hmm. And we had a journalist, the other guy that was with us, Tim Lezard, who's got a very good piece in the Statesman today, former president of the NUJ. And understandably and rightly, he was asking this guy, what was it like being there? And there was a great reluctance to talk about it because so many people had been there. And therefore, to talk about yourself was seen as a bit immodest. But the point is that they were able to separate themselves from Saddam's fascism since 1991. It was a very precarious situation. So, and they were protected by US-UK no-fly zones until what everybody, frankly, everybody at every level called liberation in 2003. So they've had a bit more time than the rest of Iraq. There's a fair degree of autonomy. The mountains are very crucial to them. The Kurds have a saying, no friends but the mountains. As time and time again, they've retreated to the mountains to regroup and fight. And beautiful, scenic, breathtaking, and all the rest of it. So they're more advanced than the rest of Iraq. But I think what you've got to understand is that the psychological and physical overhang of fascism, which was 30 years or so, will not disappear overnight. Now, if you look at Iraqi Kurdistan, Saddam murdered 182,000 people, quite deliberately, a genocidal campaign called the Anfal campaign. And we could see that the trees were starting to grow. But we also learnt, for instance, that there's a dwarfs association in Iraqi Kurdistan. And at first I didn't quite get it. But there'd been so many chemicals around that there's genital deformations, which cascade throughout the generations. And obviously dwarfs feel that there's stigma, and they formed, quite understandably, an association. But there's increased leukemia, cancer, and there are no clinics to deal with it in Iraq at all, I don't think, or certainly in Kurdistan. And so there's no foreign exchange to buy the medicine or buy the treatment abroad. It's beautiful, but the roads can sort of go from sort of fairly decent sort of roads. So we went on a very long road that had been funded by UNICEF and Save the Children back in the 90s, and then suddenly they're dirt tracks. Nice. Classes can be, we were told, 100 plus children. So electricity is intermittent. I mean, the bizarre thing was, as we're driving around, we'd stop for petrol, not at the petrol station in an oil-rich country, but guys and boys by the side of the road with the jerry cans and just pouring it in. So there's a long, long way to go. And as I say, the physical and psychological legacy of fascism is difficult to get rid of. It's manifests itself in so many ways that I think the good thing about Iraqi Kurdistan is security is much, much better. There had been, for instance, an attack in 2004 in Erbil against the headquarters of the two main parties, the KDP and the PUK, and 98 people had died in those attacks. And we went to the statue in Sami Abdul Rahman Park in Erbil. Sami Abdul Rahman was a leader of the KDP, and the park's named after him. And there's a very simple statue, and its inscription is, freedom is not free. And certainly you could see that it's not free because everywhere there's roadblocks, Kalashnikovs, yeah. You know. But, I mean, they're not immune, but they have protected themselves quite well. And the cooperation, I think, between the people and the security forces is a lot better than it is in the rest of Iraq. So hopefully at some point we'll go to the rest of Iraq, but... Well, not quite yet, unfortunately, but that day will come.
Did you get the impression from talking to people in Kurdistan that they were optimistic about the sort of reunification of the country?
They're very cheerful in a surprising way, given everything that they've been through. I think that the trade unions in Iraqi Kurdistan and the parties are very keen on finding a democratic and federal solution. I think it's also fair to say that quite a lot of people are irritated by the amount of effort that their leaders are putting into that, as opposed to improving their own conditions. But it's not for me to say, but I mean, it seems a very fair argument to put an emphasis on a federal solution as a way forward. And you've got to remember that this is a country, Kurds are spread throughout five nations.
Sure.
The Iraqi Kurdistan is surrounded by several states, Iran, where we were near, Turkey, Syria, who are pretty hostile to Iraqi Kurdistan and Kurdish aspirations.
Well, there's obviously a movement for an independent Kurdistan as well, isn't there? A Kurd nation incorporating those other countries.
Yeah, I mean, we're Labour friends of Iraq, and we'll sort of support those who are trying for a federal solution. And it seems to me that the Iraqi Kurd leaders, I mean, the president of Iraq is Talabani, are putting huge efforts into it. And it's arguable that if it weren't for those efforts, things would be a lot worse.
Sure.
So I wish them luck, and, we'll give solidarity to the trade unions throughout Iraq in their efforts to bring about that federal solution.
Can we just perhaps talk about what sort of things are British trade unions doing in a way of sort of helping and showing solidarity?
Well, there have been quite a few good things, actually. I mean, I was moaning about some of the anti-war people, but let's, as I say, remember they're a minority.
Sure.
The Fire Brigades Union have sent fire-breathing, firefighting equipment, and there are plans to send more, including fire engines, I think. The Unison, as I say, are training people, and there's been a whole stream of Iraqis coming here, and I think that's vital for us to increase our own understanding of what their needs are. The TUC have, I think, as a result of our visit, which is great, launched an appeal, which is on our website, labourfriendsofiraq.org.uk, as well as the TUC, and that's for second-hand mobile phones, because they're very expensive, and we tend to chuck them away and fill up our landfill unnecessarily. So don't chuck them away. Send them to the TUC, along with a battery charger, please, and they will be reconfigured in ways that techies might understand and I don't really care about. And they'll be put to good use by union organisers throughout Iraq. And as I say, we've got plans to try to persuade the British and wider labour movements to do more specific things. But I don't want to sort of get ahead of myself. I mean, we've got to have proper discussions with people. But essentially, they need political understanding and they need money. Mm-hmm. So that's what we're aiming to do.
Well, that's a good point to perhaps mention. What can people actually do if they wanted to contribute?
Well, I would go, first of all, to our site, and you'll get all sorts of links. But the crucial thing is that the TUC has got a solidarity fund, and I would appeal to people. I'm not going to do a Bob Geldof and swear on air, but you know what I mean.
Thank you for that.
Get out your whatever and contribute and raise it. I mean, if you're a trade union member, a Labour Party member, raise this in your organisation. And I think people want to personalise it. I think if I went along to a meeting and said, look, give us £500, and people didn't know quite what it was for, they'd be reluctant to do it, as opposed to all the other claims they have. But if I said, give us £500, and that will fund a mobile phone for a year for a trade union organiser in Basra or wherever, then that would be different. But if you go to our site, if you go to the TUC, you find all sorts of ideas, and we will be, once we've recovered from a pretty exhausting trip, doing more to specify what progressives here can do.
Okay, should we pause for a record at that moment?
Familiar, but until now, oh, oh. say to them when I'm gone, I loved your son for his sturdy arms. We both learned to cradle them, live without, oh, 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 oh. Live without, oh, 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 oh. Live without.
Listening to Resonance 104.4 FM, and you're listening to Little Atoms with me, Richard Sanderson, and with Neil Denny. And that record there was Neil Denny's choice. Very Simon and Garfunkel-esque, we thought, in here. It was called Each Coming Night, and it was by the American band Iron and Wine. Neil.
Okay, well, we're talking to Gary Kent from Labour Friends of Iraq, and we were just talking about the deputation over to Iraq of the sort of Labour MPs and trade unionists. And Gary, you met with the Iraqi teachers unions at one point, and it seems that the education system, teachers and lecturers, have been particularly hard hit by the insurgency movement. And what give us your impressions of what the situation is like over there for the education.
Yeah, I think what we learned is that 500 teachers have been murdered over the last few years. And the sense we got from the Iraqi Teachers Union, which is massive, I think about 70,000 in Baghdad alone, maybe 150,000 throughout Iraq, is that people like teachers are targeted because they're a good example. And I think basically what you've got with a lot of the so-called resistance is a nihilist attempt to exterminate all the agencies of change, the vehicles of change, including teachers, that can sort of knit a society together. Because the name of the game for them is destruction, not reconstruction. The other thing I mentioned before was that class sizes are potentially sometimes huge. I mean, we're talking about 100 plus in some classes. But the other thing is that Iraq, under Saddam's fascism, was isolated from the world for many, many years. So the textbooks have been a reflection of a one-party fascist state, and they're not up to date. And we've sort of supported an appeal called Books to Iraq, which is trying to encourage people here to send medical textbooks to Iraq, because Iraq was the crucible principle of our civilization and gave us so much intellectually, and it's about time we repaid it, is the point that Anthony Cox, who runs Books to Iraq, again on our website, I won't go through the address, you know it by now, I'm sure. So I think they are saying that they want to be part of the modern world. They want to have the best in terms of medical and political and economic knowledge. The other thing I'd say is that when we were going around Erbil and Sulaymaniyah in Iraqi Kurdistan, we went, for instance, to a cigarette factory, which has not produced a fag in years, which employs 600 people. So what that showed is that there's huge undercapacity, idle factories, and masses of hidden unemployment. And time again, trade unions were saying to us, oh, can you invest? And at first we were a bit sort of standoffish and a bit surprised because, hey, that's not our job. You know, we're trade unionists. We're not capitalists. We can't sort of give you the money. But it soon became obvious that you can't really have a trade union movement unless you've got jobs. And I'm reminded of the old sort of phrase that there's only one thing worse than being exploited by a large American multinational corporation, and that's not being exploited by a large American multinational corporation. And the point that the leader of the Kurdistan Communist Party made to us is that there's no indigenous nationalist capitalist class. So they don't have national capital that can sort of bring forward the resources to invest. So what they need is they need foreign investment. So we became used to people saying, can you invest? We said, well, we don't have the money ourselves, but we'll have words with those who do. Because, as I say, you can't have a trade union movement unless you've got jobs. And what I think we can do on the left and in the trade union movement here is we can help our comrades to be stronger as a social partner for getting foreign investors into tourism, into mineral extraction, or whatever it is. Because they know that if you get foreign investment in, there's always a shakeout and lots of people will lose a nominal job. So if you've got a strong trade union movement in Iraq, then that can sort of try to determine the terms of that exchange of technology and foreign investment. Now, that's easier said than done, sure, in the best of worlds, but they desperately need investment because they can't generate it from within.
Well, it's the foreign investment thing is an interesting point. I mean, how do we? I mean, there's been criticism that sort of the big American companies like Halliburton, etc., are basically dividing up the sort of spoils for themselves. And how do we avoid that? What can we on the left do to sort of encourage a more sort of general foreign investment to help the Iraqi people rather than American plutocrats?
It's a fair point, and certainly the guy that we were talking to from the Communist Party talked about his experience of some of the American companies as not being very honest. And there's no immediate sort of pat answer, except for saying that the stronger that the Iraqi labor movement is, and civil society and the press, mm-hmm, the more chance there is that that exploitation by foreign multinational corporations can be avoided. But, I mean, I don't want to pretend that Iraq can sort of exempt itself from the way in which the world economy is now run, but it is, absolutely always the case that the stronger your labour movement, the better chance you have of avoiding or minimising those problems.
Sure.
This article in today's New Statesman by Tim Lezard was actually quite a depressing read, I thought. It was, it's an appeal, I think, to the left, but it's also it's got quite a down feel. I mean, just for example, there's a quote from Adnan al-Safar, who says there's a genocide of working people going on in Iraq, which is, an extraordinarily shocking statement. How can we? Do you think this is the message that we should be spreading to the left in this country and to increase solidarity with the left in Iraq?
I think we have to be honest. I mean, something like 50 people a day are dying in Iraq, mostly at the hands of the insurgency. And I was there when Adnan said that, and it was a very striking thing to say. And it was only a few days ago that workers lining up for work in Baghdad were blown to smithereens. Because what you have is a movement, a small minority movement, but a very effective one in some ways. Remember that this is a country that's awash with guns and weapons, many of which were secreted by Saddam for his own reasons. He didn't quite anticipate that this was going to be the circumstances in which they were going to be used. So a lot of people who with vast military experience. I mean, we could talk until the cows come home about not the run-up to the war, but how the American authorities conducted themselves afterwards. Mm-hmm. And certainly one of the big criticisms that I've heard is about the disbandment of the Iraqi army, which all of a sudden put lots of people with huge military experience out of a job and who were, well, a bit cheesed off, to say the very least, and a resource, therefore, for...
Plenty of people who would be happy to employ them.
Yes, that's right. So no one can pretend that supporting the Iraqi labour movement or civil society organisations is by and of itself going to undermine those. But I think bit by bit... with the support of the UN, which is what we've got, the resistance can be marginalised and become less of an important factor. And I think the crucial thing now is the formation of this national unity government, that the resignation of al-Jafari, in the view of many people who we met in Iraqi Kurdistan, will result. We hope very much that that will result from it.
So this sort of brings us back to, you know, what we're debating in the first half about the opposition of some parts on the left to the Iraqi trade union movement, because what's shocking is we've talked about the Islamist sort of fundamentalist element that's a nihilistic movement that's basically doesn't want any sort of progress in the country, and they're murdering trade unionists and teachers, and obviously the Baathist element within the sort of insurgency as supporters of Saddam, and obviously we know what Saddam thought of, he banned trade unions and was murdering trade union leaders. So who do these people on the left think is gonna stand up for the, if not progressive forces on the left who are standing up for the idea of promoting democracy, who do they think is going to stand up for the working man in Iraq, or do they just not care?
Well, those idiots can speak for themselves. In a sense, what amazes me was the theory advanced at one point that it was impossible to have independent trade unionism under occupation. Well, it exists, it's there, glaring in front of our eyes. And as I say, the Iraqi trade union movement have made it very clear that they oppose the war, they want the foreign forces to be withdrawn, they want to have sovereignty back. But in a sense, I mean, it's a bit Augustinian, I think is the phrase, oh Lord, but not yet, because until they've rebuilt their security capacity, which is happening, mm-hmm. Then the withdrawal of those forces could be calamitous and could lead to even a bigger genocide of working people. So I don't really understand the theory of that part of the left who refuse to recognise the realities on the ground. And I'm basically appealing to everybody who took an anti-war position to learn how to walk and chew gum. It's perfectly reasonable, as most people in Labour Friends of Iraq did, to have opposed the invasion. But we're now 3 years on. A movement's come from nowhere and desperately needs supporting. And by walking and chewing gum, it's having two views at the same time. Mm. One is, that, yes, I oppose the war, but now I support the Iraqi left. I support the trade unions. And I think there's a bizarre situation on that part of the left, which is that they have adopted the old sort of mantra of Henry Kissinger from the 70s during the Cold War, which is, let me get this right, your enemy's enemy is your friend.
And it is a bizarre logic, which does seem to be in the ascendant, bizarrely.
Well, I think there's a part of the left that believes through these inconvenient allies, you can't be choosy, as one of them put it, the Islamists and others, that American imperialism can be given a bloody nose. And in that sort of rather messianic, Manichaean view of history, the Iraqi working class can go stuff itself, because it's an irrelevant secondary consideration to the wider need, in their view, to defeat American imperialism. And I argued in an article in Progress that one does not need to give up an anti-imperialist impulse. One does not need to forget about the vast inequalities of power and wealth. And obviously that brings in the role of America. My own history was I was radicalized by two 9/11s, the first being Chile, September the 11th, 1973. And then I think in 2001, the nature of conflict in the world changed. And what we saw was this threat to pluralism. So it seems to me that the other thing is that we have to understand that if Iraqi reformism, the left, civil society, women's groups and so on succeed, then there's every chance that, without again being rosy about it, and it's not going to happen soon, quickly, overnight, but there's every chance that Iraq can build a pretty decent democracy, which would have good impacts on the rest of the Middle East. And I just tire of those who say that, you know, the Arab street doesn't do democracy. They used to say this about Latin America. It's not true. The Arab street wants everything that we want, including democratization. And in the meantime, they certainly, in the trade union movement, want jobs and investment. And I was also very struck by the emphasis that the trade unions were putting on women's issues and getting women involved fully in the Iraqi trade union movement. I think that was a very healthy sign of a movement. Sure. That's going places.
Well, you just mentioned there a couple of world events that sort of had a radicalizing effect on yourself, and earlier in the first half you did briefly mention your background in Irish politics, and I wonder if perhaps as we're coming towards the end of the show you'd perhaps like to talk about that for a moment and whether or not you see any parallels between the sort of Irish political situation in the sort of 70s, 80s and 90s and what's going on in Iraq now.
Yeah, I'm starting to think those through and writing something about it, but I became involved with Northern Ireland in the sort of late 70s, and then more actively in British-Irish peace movements in the late 80s. We organised, for instance, something called the Peace Train, mm-hmm. which brought together parties, all parties, from Ireland, North and South, and from Britain, to come to London to demonstrate that the Irish people had no truck with terror, both loyalist and Republican. The sort of things that stand out from that sort of experience are that Northern Ireland was kept from barbarism by, amongst other things, the trade union movement. The trade union movement, which ran campaigns against sectarianism, hands off my mate, trying to reject sectarianism from the workplace, brought together Catholics and Protestants and others on the basis of common class interests. And that's an immediate parallel that one can make with Iraq, in the sense that Shias and Sunnis and others are being brought together by the Iraqi trade union movement. The other argument was about troops out.
Yeah, the
which
secular
I mentioned.
Thing is incredibly important in both cases, isn't it? The trade unions are secular organisations.
Yes, very much. And that's why, you know, the fear we have is of this attempt to create sectarian client unions. And people like Muqtada al-Sadr would be very keen on that, because they would want to foment the disintegration on sectarian lines. So that's the parallel, the importance of class politics, of common economic interests, of trade unions and other organisations, bringing people together on a secular basis. And it's a bit different, but the other thing was that the peace movement, both in Dublin and in Belfast and in London, helped to isolate those who would use terror. Now, I'm not saying that we can here, by ourselves alone, to coin a phrase, do that, but I think that the support that we can give to comrades, as I say, in the Iraqi trade unions and other organisations can help build their capacity to rebuild their society and increasingly isolate to marginalise those who are cheese offered society, who are cannon fodder for nihilist organisations and leaders, and can bit by bit move Iraq into a more decent and democratic situation.
That would be magnificent. And I really, really hope that that's going to be the case. But then if we look at the example of Northern Ireland, I mean, it's taken a long time, but the violence in Northern Ireland is considerably less than it was even 10 years ago. So does that example in Ireland also give you hope for the future of Iraq?
Yeah, I mean,
or is that a little too planned? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it is different, and let's not sort of get carried away with it. But I think that we're in the middle of a maelstrom. Things look bleak. I think the other thing I'd sort of focus on is that newspapers and television, they inevitably tend to focus on bad news. Bad news is the only news. And I've been amazed over the years that the liberal press in this country has failed or refused to focus on the successes, the small collection of successes that take place, chiefly that a movement that was reduced to 200 is now knocking on a million. Yeah, I would have thought would be, you know, a huge story for The Guardian or The Independent, but unfortunately it's not broken through. The Statesman and Progress and other papers and Tribune has carried a piece are doing that. But I think that if we can get this message across, that however we got here, there is now a movement of people who basically are saying exactly the same things as we're saying about social and economic and political issues, who want to get their country back, who want the troops out as soon as possible, then we could sort of mobilise people to put all their energies that went into stopping the war into stopping the genocide against workers that comrade from the Iraqi Federation of Trade Unions described, the media officer. And if we can then sort of turn that energy into money, so the mobile phones and all the rest of it, then there's a chance that we can't do it. I mean, obviously, we cannot isolate Sunni terror. They can. And that means creating a movement and creating jobs, because there's a lot of people hanging around with not a lot to do. And it's the old thing about the devil finding work for those with idle hands.
It's interesting you mention the press, because, I mean, I just wonder how much Labour Friends for Iraq is troubled or is caused problems simply because the press in this country, it's not very keen on Labour at the moment, is it? Or at least very little of it seems to be at the moment. So the Labour part of your name may already get you into trouble with some journalists. And they'll see that.
I haven't really found that. I mean, we're sort of a, you know, I think most people would see us as a Labour movement organisation. And certainly we try to encourage people in the Labour Party, as well as the trade unions, to take a more active position of solidarity. I think essentially what we're trying to do is we're trying to heal the wounds. Now, if we can heal the wounds, if we can help people in Iraq to heal their own wounds, and at the same time healing the wounds within the movement here, well, so much the better.
Absolutely.
But the first priority is not about you know, what happens here, but it's about supporting people on the ground in Iraq. But if that has a byproduct, then nobody's going to sort of refuse it. So, I think if your readers have any influence, please can they try and persuade broadcasters and journalists to look at what's actually happening. I mean, you know, the Dwarfs Association in Iraqi Kurdistan, fascinating.
That's a great story. I can see an article in the paper to do with that immediately. I've never heard of it before.
The Unison training session that we saw in Erbil, the Fire Brigades Union sending equipment. I mean, firefighters in Basra, I think, were fighting in their ordinary clothes and they were getting injured. So now, thanks to the Fire Brigades Union, they've got the proper equipment, you know, anti-fire, you know, things that don't burst into flames when you go into a house. So those are, you know, practical, great examples of what ordinary people have already done. I'm saying we haven't done enough, but I'm saying there's a lot more to do. And we're a small little group. We've now, you know, got some credibility, I think, by having gone to Iraqi Kurdistan. We will, I hope, be going back. We'll be encouraging people to invest because it's a beautiful country. I mean, I can't really describe it too well, but you have to go to the mountains to understand the sort of fantastic, sort of breathtaking, scenic beauty of it. And I think my own guess is that people talk about Iraqi Kurdistan being the Switzerland of the Middle East, snow-capped mountains and all the rest of it. And there's real potential. And the more tourists go there, once terrorism is fully defeated, then people will have jobs, and that's what everyone wants. And they've got huge, no pun intended, mountain to climb. In terms, as I say, that physical and psychological overhang. I mean, just think about 200,000 people being killed. I mean, the numbers of orphans, of widows, of disabled people, of mentally traumatized people, just in that one part of Iraq. And given that the whole of Iraq has gone through this massive internal repression with all these red houses everywhere, nobody trusting their neighbors, nobody able to talk freely, the secret police at every turn. This is going to be, it's a basket case in many ways. It was inevitably going to be so after that experience. I hope that the solidarity efforts that we're trying to encourage will have an impact, but it needs to be more, it needs to be bigger, and your listeners can do a lot to help increase that solidarity.
Okay, well, we're rather quickly running out of time, so Gary, can you, thanks for joining us first. You know.
Thank you for having me.
It's been a pleasure to have you on. It's labourfriendsofiraq.org.uk.
That's the one.
Our website is www.littleatoms.com. We'll be back in 2 weeks.
We're speaking to the academic and writer Frank Faridi on the 12th of May. And thanks to Richard Thomas for very ably engineering for us today.
And thanks for listening. Thanks. Thank you.